You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 24th of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, they're famous for their catchy tunes, lustrous thick hair, and a tendency to make a suburban British housewife come over all funny. But can One Direction, the boy band, cut it on the silver screen?
I know they love me, even they don't know me.
We are so thankful. This is a teamwork between us and them.
The fans were the ones who made up their minds that this band were going to be huge.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. We'll also be travelling no further than our front room in the name of a good night out, as our music guest this week specialises in hosting gigs in people's living rooms.
Stephanie on the Ferris wheel in Magna Carta Fields back when I was away.
Thus, Tom and I will welcome the return of the mother-in-law joke as the noble and daredevil art of stand-up thrives at the Edinburgh Fringe.
So plenty to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
So welcome to The Review. Tom Edwards, you and I are discussing our cultural weeks before we plough into the meat and drink of today's programme.
Emma, mine was a little light on culture this week, but I gather you've consumed enough culture to make up for that omission.
I had plenty in one morning.
Tell me about goat coats.
I was privy to the rehearsal for a performance. Well, no, three performances in London this week of a sort of an outdoor performance of classical music, then a bit of an experiment, and then it got even funnier. Just to explain, it was a project involving 200 people who went to stand at the top of Primrose Hill in London, which is one of the prettier hills in the capital, which gives an unrivaled view of, you know, our glorious city.
Very beautiful.
Very beautiful. At dusk on Thursday night, 13 classical musicians played some very challenging music at the top of the hill.
It's
and
polite,
you'd think that was it. You'd think that was your evening. And then, but oh no, the 200 strong members of the audience were given some very good quality headphones at that point, which they popped on their heads, and then they were played some very strange ambient mood music, and then they were led Pied Piper-like down the hill towards the Camden Roundhouse, which is a sort of quite cutting-edge performance area here in London. And the music, I can honestly say, no disrespect to the composer, was terrible. And then you went down a hill and then ended up at the Camden Roundhouse, and you'd think, well, that's about enough. I've done the top of my hill stuff and I've done my terrible ambient city music. But oh no, you got inside the Camden Roundhouse. And inside the Camden Roundhouse, and you joined an audience of 300 more. So there are 500 people all standing looking at this trio of classical musicians who played Stockhausen's Klang. Now, Tom, I'm not entirely sure how familiar you might be with the work of Stockhausen.
He's one of my favourites, isn't
he? Exactly, mine too. So I was very, very pleased to hear that Klang, 24 hours in the day, was being played by three men who had been commissioned Vivian Westwood, no less, to design their costumes. So they were wearing goat coats to play Stockhausen, while the audience, having had Top of the Hill, silly headphones and men in goat coats, were then instructed to wear coloured glasses, depending on which bit of the music they were listening to.
I mean, that's almost rendered me speechless.
It rendered me speechless.
I'd wear a goat coat.
I would, and I interviewed the man who played the viola, who said that the goat coat did not for one moment interfere with his performance.
There you go, that's
culture
for you.
So this is what the good people of London get up to in August, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. And you're with The Review. More goat coats may be on the way. You have to wait and see.
We're wearing yours.
On Monocle 24, we head blinking into the dark of the cinema next.
Now, anyone with an ounce of wisdom would perhaps have avoided Leicester Square in London this Tuesday, but those of a more hormonal disposition may well have found themselves suffering the glorious agony of seeing One Direction turn up for the premiere of their first film.
Bands and films, of course, are no strangers. So how will this addition to the cinematic canon fare? To answer this and to cast his eye over what the rest of cinema has to offer at the moment, we're joined by film critic Alex Godfrey. Alex, welcome.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Now, One Direction.
Mm.
I'm not a connoisseur. I'll
just a casual
there.
Fan.
Just you know, in my downtime. But perhaps I don't know where to start with this. I mean, you went to see the movie. What baggage, if any, were you bringing with you when you went to see it, or did you sort of again come to it relatively fresh?
Yeah, no baggage. I've pretty much not heard any of their music before.
You probably have done, but without realising it.
That doesn't say much for the music, you know. And I'm not averse to good pop music, but I don't think they make good pop music. But then, you know, it's not for us. I was in Leicester Square 3 days, but 2 or 3 days beforehand, and there were young people camping out already.
Mm.
Where are their parents? I don't know.
Many of them were there. There was the thousands of predominantly, was it called preteen young ladies were there, and their mothers had come down with them, because I think One Direction now are sort of, we're in an era now where the mothers were fans of Take That.
Mm.
And so they can see the point of the adoration of One Direction. And so there were dozens of women who'd come down just to have a look at, you know, whatever their names were with their great hair.
You know their names.
I don't. I know one of them's called Harry. And that's it.
That takes you up to aficionado.
Thank
Harry,
you.
Harry
that's
stepped.
It. That's absolutely fine. Now, Alex, what's this film about?
Oh, it's not about anything.
Right.
It's a celebration of the success of One Direction and Simon Cowell. It's made by Morgan Spurlock, who did Super Size Me. I did a great documentary a couple of years ago on product placement and has had a good series on. And this is basically the opposite to everything he stands for. It's like, it's basically a concert performance, which I think was from the O2 a few months ago, in 3D, which is actually quite effective. It's a better 3D than I've seen in a lot of superhero films, certainly. But it's interspersed with sort of life on the road. And he followed them around for a few months or a year and a half or whatever. And he just talks to them and they go home and meet all their parents at one point. But there's no other perspective on it. You know, the first thing you see is Simon Cowell's logo. He produced it. You know, as you know, he's, you know, picked them off the reject heap on X Factor or whatever it was and offered them fame and fortune in exchange for their souls.
What's Morgan Spurlock doing involved with this, though?
Because making lots of money,
but
I'm sure.
But is that it? Do you think that he's I did these really good movies. I exposed, you know, cynical marketing. I attacked these big international corporations. So now I am going to also take the dollar.
I don't think so. I think I can actually, it's easy to be cynical. And if I was in his position, I probably would have done it as well. He has said recently that he did it because they're, you know, the biggest band in the world at the moment. One of the biggest bands ever, horrifically. I mean, actually, there's a piece at the beginning, a piece from BBC News that says they're bigger than, they made it in America so quickly. And even the Beatles took longer. So, all right, they're bigger than the Beatles. He was offered the chance to be at the centre of this big phenomenon and film them. And he was given lots and lots of money to do it, more than he's ever had before to make a film. And I have to say, he's made a really good job in terms of fulfilling his duties.
How much is it? It's billed as a film about One Direction. How much is it about One Direction, or how much is it just as the standard artist movie, which is where you have quick snippets of them, sort of, I don't know, playing ping pong on a tour bus, and then them wowing thousands of crowds, and then going back to them saying, "I really miss my mum."
That's exactly what it is.
Okay, right. Fine.
It's not the Stones at Altamont. There's no. it's not a wry sideways look at it. There's no mention of Harry Styles' sexual conquest. There's no tabloid stuff in it. There's none of that whatsoever.
What a shame.
It's just everyone's patting each other on the back.
Should we have a little quick listen to it and just see?
No.
Come on. Our lucky listeners are going to. They're going to have
the
this.
Housewives
they're going to have a clip whether we like it or not.
The Housewives are desperate for it, Alex. They always make fans laugh.
I know they love me, even they don't know me.
We are so thankful. This is a teamwork between us and them.
The fans were the ones who made up their minds that this band were going to be huge.
The hard thing about the travel is missing home.
We just come from normal working class families. If I
let you know. Hello, sunshine.
I know you always used to say, I'll get your house when I'm older. For you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's lovely.
Thank you for what you've done for us.
I'm so proud of you.
Well, get off the phone.
See, that sounds lovely, Alex.
It is lovely for like 100 minutes. I tell you what, for any grown-ups who are interested in the phenomenon, if you didn't see the Channel 4 documentary a couple of weeks ago on One Direction's fans, that's much more interesting and insane. And that's still on the internet. But don't go watch this.
Don't go watch it at all.
Unless, you know, you're strong-armed by your kids. Because there's nothing in it for grown-up people.
Right.
Great. Well, let's,
fair enough. Thank you very much for drawing a line under that one. Then,
let's move on. Let's move on to decidedly grown-up subject matter of Lovelace. Now, I'm kind of looking forward to this picture. It's obviously looking back at a really intriguing time in terms of the porn industry and entertainment and the various issues that were thrown up by that. I wonder, does this biopic of Linda Lovelace actually address any of the big questions, or is it more of an entertainment picture?
It's not. I don't think it's an attempt to tackle the big questions in that industry. It's very much her story, but then her story is one of the most defining stories, certainly of that era in pornography. And I actually really like the film. It's made by a couple of people, who used to do documentaries. They made Howl 2 or 3 years ago, which was the Allen Ginsberg film with James Franco, and they're interesting. But I don't know how much people know about Linda Lovelace, apart from the fact that she was in this film, Deep Throat, and she was abused in all manner of ways by her husband, who she then divorced and railed against. And she was brought into this world and then later on became an anti-porn campaigner and turned her back on it all and died. But it's an interesting film because it shows two opposing viewpoints. It shows her being brought into this film with rose-tinted glasses, and it's all lovely and glamorous, and she meets this guy who's very exciting, and she has all these adventures in the porn industry. And then about halfway through, it sort of switches and does it all again from the viewpoint of what she said really happened, which is all terrible, terrible business. And that's really interesting.
Does it work as a drama in itself, or would this film only really work simply because it's the story of someone who was so famous?
No, I think it's really interesting. I mean, you know, it's obviously meant to entertain people who might not know her as much as people who do. I don't think she's that famous apart from, you know, the general facts that people might know. And Amanda Seyfried plays Linda, and she's really, really strong in it. She's really charismatic, you know. It's not a fun film. It's all pretty awful stuff. It's getting criticised by some people for being a bit of a TV drama, a bit melodramatic. But I think it's interesting. Sharon Stone plays a mother. She's really great, the stern Catholic mother. And Peter Sarsgaard as Chuck Traynor, who is the husband, is really menacing and awful in it.
It's a great bit of proper old school villainy on screen, isn't it, from Peter Sarsgaard?
Yeah,
great.
He's good. He's a great actor. Lindsay Lohan was originally down to play Linda. That didn't work out. That would have been interesting.
Let's have a listen.
How does it feel to be the poster girl for the sexual revolution?
To me, it's a movie, like any other movie, only it has so many better things in it.
Like what?
Like me.
Does she even know what she's auditioning for?
She's adorable, but we traffic in fantasy here. You know, more pizzazz.
I want to show you this movie we made.
Oh, are you actually doing that?
Action.
We are all going to win Oscars.
The pornographic film Deep Throat has become one of the most popular movies of all time.
Hi, Mr. Hefner.
Hefner, please.
Your girl's going to be a star.
What about me?
Some great performances there. You mentioned Rob Epstein, Jeffrey Friedman made this movie A Howl with James Franco. James Franco is also in this. You mentioned Amanda Seyfried, Peter Sarsgaard, Sharon Stone, Hank Azaria as well. Mm-hmm. Great performances. Is it a great movie? Could it win come award season?
No, it won't win anything. Amanda Seyfried is very good, but you know there are better performances around at the moment. But you know I did think she was great in it, and like I say, Sharon Stone was really good. But it's just one of those films that I think it's really interesting. It's compelling in parts. It's got a lot of personality. It's not an absolute must see. It's interesting.
Is it due to the fact that the girl herself, Linda Lovelace, she's exploited for the first half of the movie, but she doesn't strike anybody as being particularly bright? She's this incredibly naive creature.
She is, and actually, it seems that in real life she was a complete mess of contradictions, and a lot of people discredit a lot of things that she said, and nobody knows quite what to believe. But you know, she may not be. You know, she's not a protagonist. It's like everything that happens to her and around her is really fascinating, though.
Let's move on to another film that's out now. It's I saw the trailer of this and was quite astonished by how noisy it was. Pain and Gain.
It's Michael Bay, who did Transformers and Pearl Harbor.
Enough
and Armageddon.
Enough said.
He likes noise.
Let's have a listen.
My name is Daniel Lugo, and I believe in fitness. All this began because it was time to push myself harder.
Oh, there you go, yes!
Otherwise, I was looking at another 40 years of wearing sweatpants to work.
Mr. Doble, are you currently using steroids?
I think they messed me up.
Hey, was this guy tired of being where you are, Adrian?
No. I kind of like it here. I mean, the weights are new to
me. I mean, in life, man.
You just can't kidnap a guy and take his things. That's so illegal.
Sure we can.
Victor Kershaw is a criminal prick who deserves bad stuff to happen to him.
A little excerpt of Pain and Gain there. Alex, tell us what this film is about.
It's based, I think somewhat loosely in parts, on a true story about some bodybuilders extorting, kidnapping and killing people in Miami, I believe, in the 1990s. Mark Wahlberg is the lead, and he's supported by Anthony Mackie and Dwayne Johnson, who is otherwise known as The Rock. And it's a big, insane bundle of fun. I have to say, I found it really unique, extremely entertaining, really funny, really bonkers. And don't be put off by Michael Bay's CV if you don't like those other films he's made, because it's really not a lot like that at all. It's just as ridiculous, but it's really crazy.
He's a bit of a sort of spiritual successor to the kind of 80s Bruckheimer Simpson power movie. Yeah. There'd always be a place for that, won't there? As long as it's done with a bit of wit and a bit of elan.
Yeah, and this isn't one of, I mean, you know, a lot of the films he did were with Bruckheimer, you know, The Rock and Armageddon and Con Air. He didn't do Con Air. But, you know, Bruckheimer's got The Lone Ranger out at the moment, which isn't a patch on this. This is, it's different, you know. It's not as much of an easy sell. It's not as dunderheaded as some of those films. It's really odd. And I've got to say, The Rock is fantastic in it. He's a revelation. He's
why
hilarious.
Why do you think the film's odd?
Because the story is just off the hook. The things that happen in it, it's one of those films where you're going, I can't quite believe what I'm watching. The torture scenes in it are just crazy. They kill and dismember someone or some people at one point, and then they realise they can't just bury it and the fingerprints can be identified. So one of them grills the hands on a barbecue to get the fingerprints off. You know, there's just things like that happening every 5 minutes and you can't quite get over it. And there's things that pop up in the film saying, this is still actually true. This is what happened.
Does that? I mean, it sounds absolutely extraordinary. It doesn't sound particularly watchable, though.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's just, I mean, you know, there's an amazing energy to it. Michael Bay knows how to keep things going, you know, and it's very flashy and it's very, very fast moving. It's kind of this big Technicolor madness.
Alex, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. Out of the three, which one do we go and see?
One Direction.
Brilliant. Out around the world now. I think, no, its premiere is next week, isn't it? And it has a list as long as your arm of the countries where it will be showing. You're listening to The Review. Our weekend look ahead is next.
Come with us from Georgia before we zip to Istanbul on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Emma Nelson.
Time to cross to our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gotcheva, for her weekly digest of cultural treats that she's dug out from around the world for you to enjoy.
This weekend in Toronto, the Lonsdale Gallery welcomes So the Splendor by Toronto-based artist Oisin Haruthoyan. Creating a visual escape into outer space, the show features a collection of altered black and white photos and collages of negatives. The exhibition is on until the 15th of September. In Tokyo, the Museum of Contemporary Art hosts the Gibraltar Focus exhibition by Francis Alice. The Belgian artist is based in Mexico but travels around the world to document today's social and political realities. He returns to the Museum of Contemporary Art with the second part of his solo project. It features about 100 works inspired by the Strait of Gibraltar. The exhibition is on until the 8th of September. São Paulo welcomes the 7th edition of the SP Arte Photo Fair. It is considered Brazil's most important photography event. Around 250 pieces by various international photographers are on display, with a focus on local talent such as Vic Muniz, Gaspar Kasparian, and Sebastião Salgado. As for the galleries, we recommend A Casa de Luz Vermelha from Brasília and Camara Ka from Belém. For more details, go to sp-arte.com. Film lovers opening at cinemas across the UK this weekend is What May Seem You, Scott McGeehy and David Siegel's latest film based on the Henry James's novel from 1897. Adapted for modern-day New York City, the film tackles valid contemporary issues such as family ties and custody battles. And finally this weekend, we're listening to the new album from Detroit producer Shigito. It's called No Better Time Than Now. And from it, this is Ringleader. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was Ringleader by Shigeto. Ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
It's time now for our weekly music review. Our next guest is perhaps rather used to having his work described as lounge music. We do apologise, therefore, to Tom Lovett, part of Sofa Sounds Collective.
Hello.
It's an organisation which describes itself as creating secret, intimate gigs in living rooms around the world, making people some very unpopular neighbours, no doubt. Tom, how do you pronounce the name of your group?
That's a good question. Nobody knows. So it's Sofa Sounds.
Sofa Sounds.
Yeah. And I should say, we've done, 450 shows, I think. We've only ever had one noise complaint from a neighbour.
I was going to ask you about that, because not just, I guess, angry neighbours, that's a pretty good record. Any other sort of unforeseen interruptions, you know, cats running in or...
There's so many pets. Pets are... We were doing a show once, and literally the cat threw up on the bass player in the middle of his set.
And was that a sort of piece of musical criticism, or the cat? It was just a coincidence, perhaps.
So you make little concerts in people's living rooms.
Yeah. So
how did that come about?
It was a couple of years ago. It was a couple of guys in London, and they were kind of going to shows and. You know, they were kind of getting sick of that gig-going experience where you turn up, it's some dank, horrible venue and everyone talks over the band you're there to see and leaves halfway through. And they were like, well, actually, you know, maybe we can do something different. So they put on a show in their flat in London, filmed it, put it online. Someone from New York got in touch and said, oh, this is cool, can we do one? And then that was... you know, 2 years ago, and now we do shows in about 40 cities, about one gig a day, somewhere around the world.
And what kind of music are you putting in people's lounges? I mean, there was a thing a few years ago about, I think the Victoria and Albert Museum was asked not to have Metallica come and play in them due to obvious structural risks that were being enacted. As a result, you know, bearing that in mind, who do you let play in living rooms?
I mean... you know, in terms of setup, it's always kind of stripped back to one extent or another. Though we just did our first all electronic show at in a flat out in Queen's Park. That was pretty cool. That was pretty loud. but it's a real mix. And what we try and do is we'll book sort of emerging acts that people may or may not know, and then also some complete unknowns. So we have a lot of music that gets submitted to us for people who want to play, and there's a huge team, about 30 listeners worldwide, who vote on the submissions. And if you get enough votes, then So is in.
Is it as much about then providing a forum then for new artists, or is it more about connecting in a more intimate way? You know, taking performance back to something more intimate and a bit more.
It's both in a sense. It's the idea of our vision has always been to create this huge intimate music discovery community, so that we can maybe take an act that we love and break them overnight through this community, because we think they deserve that that exposure. I mean, when it started in the first place, it was there almost to give a platform that reflected the sort of respect that we thought artists weren't getting in the normal life experience, you know.
How do you marry the choice of venue with the choice of artist? Because if you go to a normal concert hall, then they are expected to get, you know, all manner of acts coming through their doors. But to invite someone into your living room is quite an intimate gesture in many ways. Mm. So you really want something that you like being played in your lounge.
Yeah, it's true. Well, we just have to make sure we get good stuff.
Well, on that subject, maybe let's take a listen to some of the tracks. I think we'll start off with Goldheart Assembly. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so I've known the boys for quite a long time. They've just signed with New Music Club, who are a great little label. And this track, I heard it ages ago, but they're finally putting it out. And it's doing the rounds on the radio at the moment. But they came and played for us in a flat in Acton, actually, back a couple of months ago. And it was great. It was a beautiful evening. And there's like a football game going on behind them in the garden, and it was actually just a really lovely moment in the evening. This song
sounds like a perfect example of a Sci-Fi Sounds recording. Mm-hmm. Let's take a listen now.
Too far from here, so just keep your eyes from the sky. Diamond mile, so just keep your eyes, from the sky. The distance collides, you'll still be happy. Stephanie on the
face. Sounded like everyone was having particular fun then.
There was what was tickling the
lusty
audience?
Chuckles.
Their drummer kept going out of time. And every time he did, the whole band would sort of turn to look at him. You know, they were like, dude, come on. you had one chance. But I mean, that's the really nice thing. You know, you get that you're so close to the band that you're kind of in there in the moment with them, you know. And it's again, it's that kind of intimate way of actually experiencing.
Do you think people who are watching the shows, their sort of whole experience of the music changes because of that delivery? I mean, it's different listening in your own home, I guess, anyway. But do you think it actually lends the actual music a different quality almost in the ears of those who are joining?
Yeah, I mean, there's this weird atmosphere of tension almost, good tension, you know. And it's that tension of you're there with 100 people, all sat down in complete silence, all engaging with this with this thing that's happening right there, and won't happen again, you know,
How do you get, I mean, you mentioned that you've got 100 people listening there. I mean, I don't know many living rooms in London that could fit 100 people. I mean, what do you do in terms of, you know, the boring things of logistics, getting people in, getting people out, stopping gate crashes, stopping cats?
So we have announced the way you get to come is you apply on the Sofa Sounds website, and then if you get, you apply for a date, and if you get in, you get you get told you're in, and then you get the address on the day in an email. So you you go off to like some godforsaken flat in northwest London or in over in east, and then you just turn up, you rock up. We start at like 8 o'clock, finishes at 10:30, and everybody just leaves. Or some of the more enterprising flats set up a little bar on the side.
Canny operators.
Charging? No, surely.
But I mean, it's funny. Like the actually finding the flats is one of the easiest parts of it. I think it's literally like, you know, if you've got a cool flat, you kind of want to show it off.
Exactly. I can work that. And does it ever go too far the other way? I mean, Emma mentioned gate crashes in passing. Then do you ever get passers by saying, "Oh, Ty, what's happening in here? Mind if we?" Well, getting on the act.
Well, I mean, I guess we've never had any neighbour complaints because all the neighbours come.
Lovely. Let's move on to your second choice, Rainer and Girls. Tell us a bit more about this, why you've chosen it.
So this is just coming out, I think it's in about a month's time, on ASL Records. But I just think it's just such a cool track. And we haven't had Rainer in to play a session yet. But she's just really cool. She's cooler than me. Well,
like, impossible.
Makes me feel shockingly uncool.
Tom, I wondered, it's interesting, you've got emerging artists, and as you mentioned, some, you know, unsigned, starting out from the bottom up. What's been the reaction to what you guys are doing from, I guess, some of the established players in the music business? Are they sort of like, are they worried? Do they sort of say, oh, what are these guys up to? We're not like where this is going. Or is there a sense that maybe some of the established players are losing a bit of control about who gets the shots because, you know, you guys are giving them a great platform?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's... you know, nobody knows what the hell's going on in the industry at the moment. But, you know, I guess we're used sometimes as a bit of a A&R network. I mean, our, in terms of, we talk about gate crushes, A&R guys are always turning up for these shows. I don't know how they find out about it. We did a show that was back about 9 months ago. And it was a guy who went on to be signed by one of the A&R guys in the crowd there, but there was three heads of A&Rs from three different major labels,
which makes your,
stood next to each other.
And that makes your whole operation then completely different, because you will then get the artists knowing that if they play one of your gigs, they could well find three A&R men on someone's sofa.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, we genuinely try to like curate the audience as much as we curate the lineup. And it's about providing just a great space for stuff to happen in. So we try and get music fans and industry professionals and tastemakers. You know, that's such a horrible word. I can't believe that passed my mouth.
There are some of them out there. I just wondered, you mentioned, you know, obviously it sort of works around the world. Does it work differently in different countries? Is there a different sort of atmosphere? Do people have different expectations? Or does the kind of living room vibe, does that travel, or is it a bit different wherever you go?
Yeah, I mean that's one of the nicest things, is sort of seeing how it's slightly tweaked every time. So a show in Sao Paulo has a slightly, you know, different atmosphere to a show in Belgium or we've just started doing shows in Beijing and in Mumbai, and there it's weird for them. our team out in Mumbai was saying, like, you know, we're freaking people out, saying, "Oh, just come, you know, just come to this random flat," because it's not part of their culture at all yet. But you know, what we try and provide is the same atmosphere every time.
Let's move on to your next choice of music, Frugal Father, and the finally titled Redheaded Hipster.
This is genuinely my favourite song of the year. I have no idea why.
Tell it. Well, let's have a listen and we'll talk about it.
We stayed up late. Your roommate's eyes were kind of crooked, but we were both dancing pretty great. And no one thought about a thing that wasn't in the room without blessing.
I see why you're into that. It's got a kind of, there's a nice kind of LCD sound system vibe going with that.
It's such a wry song lyrically, you know. It's got these great lines in it all the way through.
I'm afraid time is running out, so we've got one more choice to play, which is Fimba Bravo, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But before we leave this, Tom, I do want to ask you this, and maybe you could answer it as creatively as you can. What is what was the strangest living room you've ever found yourself in? Or the most memorable?
Actually, this Fimba Bravo set was a great one for that. It was a warehouse out in Hackney Wick, and there was these five Italian girls living there, and they just moved in, and it was getting dark, and the audience were all just arriving, and we had Fimba Bravo opening, and I said to the girls, "Can we switch on the lights? Because, you know, it's getting pretty dark, and there's a film crew here, you know." And they were like, "Oh, actually, no, the lights don't work." I was like, "Okay." And we had to go
new set of challenges.
And we had to go room to room through this whole like block of lofts, knocking on every door, saying, "Can we borrow a lamp?" And by the end, we had this kind of almost like quadrophenia set up in front of the stage of like 20 lamps, all casting on the band, and it was amazing. And it was probably the most atmospheric show I've been to. So it was a good thing out of disaster.
Tom, love it. Let's give us your final choice then, please, for our music review today. You've just had Frugal Fire, the Fimba Bravo. Tell us about The Way We Live Today.
So this is sung by Alexis from Hot Chip, actually. So it's, but the guy, Fimba Bravo, has been making music, like steel pan music, for decades, I think, and is just an absolute dude. He spent most of the gig swigging like bootleg rum in the corner.
And you can't tell. Let's have it here. Listen. That was Fimba Bravo, The Way We Live Today, the final choice of our musical guest, Tom Lovett, part of Sofa Sounds Collective. Sign up to his website and you might be in his living room, or he might be in your living room sometime soon.
Time next, on the review, to shine a light on one corner of the world which has particularly rich cultural pickings this weekend. Today, it's the turn of Los Angeles, and Monocle's Barrett Austin is here to guide us through it.
It's difficult to imagine a bad time to visit Los Angeles, and in August, when the mercury continues its skyward assault on most parts of America, LA's sublime microclimate provides a welcome hint of seasons to come. A weekend in the City of Angels promises a fair dose of excitement, but we think the coming few days are especially exciting. A stone's throw from downtown, the 10th annual edition of the city's famed FYF Festival begins Saturday. Held on site at the Los Angeles State Historic Park, FYF brings together a well-selected cross-section of contemporary musicians ranging from Syrian-born Omar Suleiman, soul hero Charles Bradley, and modern favorites like Beach House, Washed Out, and TV on the Radio. FYF opens Saturday afternoon and runs through the weekend.
Why is it so hard to make it in America? I tried.
If it's not an open-air weekend of loud, banging music you're after, Werner Herzog's five-channel sound and video installation at the Getty Museum might be your ticket. Since 1997, the Hilltop Getty Museum has curated some of the best shows in town, and Herzog's Hearsay of the Soul is no exception. Combining visual work of Dutch Golden Age painter Hercules Seegers with the wailing cello of Ernst Reitzeger, the German filmmaker's sensory-driven exhibition is nothing if not unique. And while you're there, be sure to take the full tour of the Getty's Richard Meyer-designed home, perched high in the Santa Monica Mountains, towering over Interstate 405. If you're starting to work up an appetite and don't mind launching yourself into a bit of a crowd, we recommend a visit to the Los Angeles Food and Wine Festival. Now in its third year, the week-long festival brings together some of the country's top chefs and top talents from the world of food and beverage. Skip the grand tasting on Saturday, which is sure to be the most crowded, and instead visit Bacon and Bourbon with Kentucky chef Edward Lee. The name alone may seem a tad revolting, but Lee's tasting menu of pork bites and small batch bourbons will not disappoint. For a perfect end to a busy LA day, take the short drive to West Hollywood for an early evening cocktail in the courtyard at the Chateau Marmont. Privacy comes at a premium in Los Angeles, and the Chateau's classical interior courtyard and ground floor lounge give a sense of Hollywood's old world charm. History oozes from the walls here. F. Scott Fitzgerald's Heart Attack, the backdrop of Sofia Coppola's film Somewhere, the former Hollywood home to dozens of actors, writers, and artists. Find yourself in the courtyard, order an Aperol Spritz, and look up and see if you can spot any stars in the bright LA sky. For Monocle, I'm Barrett Austin.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you are in Los Angeles, you know what to do now. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back with a rib tickler next as we get the best of the Edinburgh Fringe's comedy.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back. You're with The Review with me, Tom Edwards, and Emma Nelson. This year's Edinburgh Festival, or more precisely the comedy bits of it, have been dominated by two things. There's been the return of stand-up, which is to be welcomed, given that so much of last year's reviews were given over to the popularity of mime, if memory serves. And second, many of the stand-ups have been women.
Our next guest has devoted the past weeks to finding the funniest at the fringe. Bruce Dessau is the editor of Beyond the Joke, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the review to give us his roundup of all things fringe and funny. Welcome once again, Bruce. Lovely to have you back on the programme. We're in the sort of the death throes or the final glories of the Edinburgh Fringe. Yeah. How's it been for you?
It's been a very good fringe for me, personally and professionally. There have been very few shows that have been what you would call five-star shows, but the quality, I mean, so many shows have been four-star shows. The quality just seems to get consistently higher each year. I think, you know, no pun intended, but I think performers take comedy more seriously than ever. You know, I think they just work really hard at it and they get a proper show. So in the past, I've been to Edinburgh and in the first week, the shows aren't even ready. They're still sort of previewing them. But now I think they do so many previews before they come up that they're ready from day one. So it's been really good.
Now, one thing they are pretty serious about, Bruce, is the actual awards. Mm-hmm. I gather Edinburgh Comedy Awards, we're sort of imminent to learning the winner. Who are the front runners? Which way do you think this one might go?
Well, I think you mentioned before that it's a sort of women's year, and I think that's the case with the awards. One of the first shows I saw, it seems so long ago now, it's 3 weeks ago, was Bridget Christie. She did a show, you know, in a small venue in the wrong side of the city at 11 o'clock in the morning, and it was packed from day one. And it's called A Bic for Her, Bic as in the biros. And it's a combination of very silly jokes and quite serious discussion of feminism and male attitudes to women and lad mags and things like that. So it sort of appeals to everyone. It appeals to people that like humour, simple humour, because it's funny. And then it appeals to the intellectuals because it's about feminism. So I think she's probably the front runner. And the meeting is going on as we speak. After this, the announcement is at 2 o'clock this afternoon in Edinburgh.
There was a quote by obviously regular referee of Monocle 24, Peter Stringfellow, who once rather misguidedly said that you can't be pretty and funny. You can only be one or the two if you're a woman. Well, is there a kind of, I mean, to what degree of people have women been trying to break out of that?
Yeah, I think maybe Peter Stringfellow has never met Bridget Christie then. She's quite pretty. Yeah, it's a combination. I don't think, you know, I think there was this tradition of women that were slightly, quirky characters in the past. But now women aren't, you know, they just go on stage in jeans and a T-shirt in the way that maybe, you know, men do. There's not a sense that women have to be glamorous or have to look eccentric. They just go on stage and do their thing. And that's what Bridget does. And there are other women. Sarah Pascoe is very good. There's a Best Newcomer Award announced this afternoon as well. And the front runner for that's a woman as well, Aisling B, who's an Irish comedian who's recently moved to London. She's great as well. So, you know, and I think this whole sort of idea of can women be funny, or, you know, I think this year Edinburgh is going to confirm what I've known all along, that women can be funny.
Bruce, we talked a couple of weeks ago about what we were expecting to see and whether there'd be, you know, political stand-up, whether there was the same appetite for people to, you know, attack politics with the same kind of vim that they did in the 1980s. And now, with your sort of hindsight abilities, with the whole festival sort of winding down, has there still been political comedy? You mentioned Bridget Christie talking about feminism.
Yeah.
Are people still tackling, you know, big issues, or are people looking for a bit of escapism with their jokes as much as with everything else?
Well, I think when there's 600 shows on, you can sort of find something. There is really is something for everyone, from stupidity and, you know, and there's still clowns. There's still a bit of mime here, although, as you said, mime hasn't done so well in the awards this year.
Right through
to politics. Since I last spoke to you, you know, I saw a show by a comedian who's also a DJ called Matt Ford, who hosts a radio show in London. But he's a stand-up comedian as well. And his show is all about politics. His show is, you know, it's obviously being very critical of all the parties. He doesn't take a particular stance. He's, you know, he's sort of quite, you know, cynical about politics in general. There's another show by Steve Richards, who's actually a political journalist, who's doing a stand-up comedy show, trying to bring politics onto the fringe. So politics is there. But, yeah, there's maybe a sense that comedians aren't sort of, it's not like the sort of Margaret Thatcher bashing days when comedians were trying to bring down the government or felt that they might be able to bring down the government. I think maybe it's they're letting the democratic process bring down the government instead.
There was a review in some of the papers just over the last couple of weeks saying that the mother-in-law joke is making a comeback. Please tell us whether this is true or not. I'm desperate to know.
Oh, maybe you read my article. I read something about it. Yeah, it was, but it's mother-in-law with a twist, and I'm not going to defend it. But
I don't think I can bear that.
It's kind of, you know, the comedian I saw doing that sort of thing. I don't know if it's the same one. Was a guy called Mike Wozniak, who's lives in Exeter, he's in England, and yeah, he's, you know, you can tell that he's sort of sending up that style because, you know, he's a young guy, sort of late 30s, early 40s, reasonably young anyway. You know, he wears a bow tie and a frilly shirt and he has a sparkly curtain behind him, just like the comedians in the 1970s would have had. And he does jokes because his show is about the fact that his mother-in-law and his father, for economic reasons, have moved in with him. So he's got them under, you know, squeezed into his small house. But, you know, because it's at the Edinburgh Fringe and because it's in a tight, in fact, it's the same venue as Bridget Christie, he's doing it with a twist. You know that it's ironic mother-in-law jokes, I think you'd call them.
Bruce, let's move on. I know a little earlier this week you were a judge at So You Think You're Funny. Lots of great names have emerged from that down the years. Mm. It's really for sort of total newcomers. Who did you furnish the prizes on, and will we be seeing them around for years to come?
Yeah, I think this is really the sort of the nursery slopes. This is where they start. But, you know, I've only got to say that, you know, one of the winners of this about 15 years ago was Peter Kay. You know, Peter Kay won this, and he's, you know, how many nights did he do at the O2 Arena last year? You know, he's an absolute, you know, superstar of comedy, and he started in this. People like Dylan Moran and Tommy Tiernan have won this before. And this year, again, the standard was high. In fact, the standard was so high that when it came to judging, it was a tie. For the first time, this competition has been going for 26 years. So You Think You're Funny, it's called. And we gave it to two of the nine people. Again, another woman, Demi Lardner, her name is. She's from Australia. And Ed Hedges, who's from Essex. And the amazing thing is, apart from the fact that they're both 19, that they couldn't be more different. Ed Hedges is a sort of 6 foot plus bearded teenager, as I said, just massive guy, looks like a farmer. And Demi Lardner, although she's a 19-year-old woman, looks like a 13-year-old boy. She's probably about 4 foot. She's certainly under 5 feet, about 4'6". And yeah, you couldn't. They were both. It just again shows how comedy can be different. That they were both equally funny. That we gave the prize to both of them. I think what I was thinking about was, you know, do you remember that Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito film, Twins?
Of course,
very well. Yes. Very well. If they ever decide to regularly, yes, of course.
Yeah. Well, if I was looking at the photo of these two together, and I was thinking, if they ever decide to remake that, like, you know, with a twist of having one of them as a woman as well, these two, it was amazing. You know, they just look. You know, he completely towers over her, and she's very quirky. She wears a little bow tie and a white shirt, and I think they'll both, you know, there'll be names. You know, in 10 years' time, I wouldn't necessarily say they'll be playing arena shows. But they'll be one way or another, they'll be famous. They'll either be actors or they'll have a sitcom or they'll be doing stand-up shows around the world. But they will. Demi Lardner and Ed Hedges. You heard it here first.
You mentioned, though, in several things in terms of the breadth of the kind of stuff that you're getting to see and what you're getting to judge, Bruce. You know, you're talking the physicality of the performers. And you also said that there's, 600 comedy acts here in Edinburgh. When you're trying to decide who is the outstanding performer and all that, and it can't just be all about jokes, can it? Because there are so many different factors that are at play.
Absolutely. And in the awards, you know, the award that's being announced this afternoon, you're judging, there's stand-up comedians, but then there's also a sketch duo, Max and Ivan, and how do you, you know, and their show is almost like a little play. It's sketches, but they're linked by a story. So how do you judge that against someone like Sean Walsh, who is a, you know, will, whether he wins the award or not this afternoon, Sean Walsh is another person who will be a star. And it's just, you know, with him, you could just, you know, every line is a joke. Every line you could, you know, give him a point for because it's funny. Whereas Max and Ivan, it's more about characters. So, yeah, it's very hard. And I have been in competitions where I've judged them and I've seen another judge next to me. He just does it on a points basis, that every time the audience laughs, he gives that act another point.
It's like boxing.
Yeah, and then adds up the points at the end. And I think, you know, this is why the meeting they're having today, you know, the meeting they had to decide the shortlist on Wednesday was the longest meeting they'd ever had. I think it took 6 hours to decide on 7 nominees, because it is really hard. And, you know, when you've got a panel of, I think there were sort of 11 or 12 judges, everyone has their own favourites. Everyone, you know, I'm a fan of stand-up comedy more so than sketch shows. Everyone has their own little prejudices and their own little favourites. And yeah, you take into account the character and the quality of the performance, and then if they're doing jokes, you think to yourself, well, does it matter if they've written these? As long as the jokes are original, does it matter if somebody has written the jokes for them? Do they have to write their own material? But sometimes, some years, a winner sticks out. These things don't matter in the end, because sometimes there's a consensus. And I think this year, I think it's between, going back to the Comedy Awards, I think it's between, there are 7 nominees, but I think it's down to Bridget Christie or Sean Walsh as the final two. And I think the consensus will probably go in Bridget Christie's favour.
Bruce, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Bruce Dessau, comedy journalist and editor of Beyond the Joke. Thank you for your time over the Edinburgh Fringe.
Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure. If you'd like to hear a bit more about what went on at this year's Fringe, tune into Monday's Culture Show for a colourful report on some of the more unusual happenings in Edinburgh this year. That brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from us here at Midori House. Our thanks to our producer, Katie Bilboa, and to Fernanda Augusta Pacheco too, and to our researcher, Ilias Simos, and our studio manager, Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina Godwin now with the weekend edition, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on the Curator 1300.
And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Robert Bound and Sophie Grove. But you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.